Good morning and welcome to all of you. It is a wonderful day, a wonderful time to celebrate being together and to have as a guest of both of our congregations a remarkable man. In a world of sound bites and talking, shouting, screaming heads, there are not an awful lot of what I would call public intellectuals, people who can take complicated ideas and advance them with elegance, creating conversations of respect and thought-provoking ideas. Jonathan Kirsch is such a rare person. In Los Angeles, probably not since Frank Baxter have we had somebody who plays this role. For you young people, that's not Ted Baxter, that's Frank Baxter, and there's no relationship whatsoever. Jonathan Kirsch is a lawyer, a scholar, a speaker, a writer of many books, and a provoker of many ideas. And we are very happy to have him with us today. It is a treat. And welcome to you, Jonathan Kirsch.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Reverend Dober, my fellow Jonathan, for beautiful words of welcome. Thank you, Rabbi Milhander, for making me welcome in your shul today. Thank you all for allowing me to spend a few moments and share some ideas with you. I'm going to talk a little bit about some ideas and some information that I've written about in my latest book, which is called God Against the Gods. It's a book that I like to say tells about the dark side of monotheism and the bright side of paganism. Paganism is a system of beliefs and practices that has gotten a very bad rap in the Western world for about 2,500 years now. We are taught to think of paganism as something dark and primitive and superstitious and barbaric. And before our short time together is over, I hope you'll see that, in fact, it has some very elevated and exalted ideas. And above all of us in this room today, all of us in the United States of America, are a little pagan at heart. I want to start by acknowledging, as I always feel obliged to do, that although I am going to point out some problems with what we like to call, in a kind of a self-congratulatory way, ethical monotheism, the faith of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, I do want to acknowledge that, in fact, it is an ethical monotheism, it is an ethical belief system, and it has some very exalted and elevating ideas as well. They're in evidence here today with the food that you've collected. The prophet Isaiah asks, what is the fast that God desires? It is to share your bread with the hungry, as you've done today, to take the wretched poor into your home, and when you see the naked, to clothe him. Jesus, in what I, for me personally, is the most single most sublime moment in the New Testament, says to the blessed, I was hungry and you gave me meat. He was echoing the words of Isaiah consciously. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. But all of those ideas can be understood to apply to those people who we know well because they are like us. They are of our tribe, they are of our community, of our family, they share our skin color, our language, and above all, our religious beliefs. There is a still more exalted moment in the Bible, a far more exalted moment. It's a commandment that God gives to the children of Israel. He has already commanded them to do a great many things, 613 different commandments in Jewish tradition. But he has commanded the children of Israel to do things for the benefit of the ger, the stranger, the other, the people who are not like ourselves, who do not have our belief systems. We're commanded to respect the stranger. We're commanded to protect the stranger. And at this moment that I'm referring to, we are commanded even to love the stranger In Leviticus we read, "The stranger who settles among you shall be treated as the homeborn. You shall love him as a person like yourself because you were strangers once in the land of Egypt." That is the beautiful message of monotheism. However, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to challenge you to bear in mind that that's not the only message of monotheism. And elsewhere in the Bible, in many more places in the Bible, God commands ruthless, cruel, and hateful actions towards the ger, towards the stranger. The story of the Exodus, which we celebrate today as a story of freedom and emancipation, is also the story, if I may be blunt, of genocide. God commands the Israelites to march into a land that is not their own and to slay those that they find there. You shall not only tear down their altars and smash their idols, as God commands them, but God says, "A fire is kindled in my anger. The sword without and the terror within shall destroy the young man and the virgin, the suckling and the man with gray hairs." And why? Because they are different. That's part of the theology of monotheism, too. And we live in an era where that message is tragically prominent in our experience of the great monotheistic religions. My book was written in the shadow, as so much of what we do today is, in the shadow of the events of 9/11. On that day, men who were committed monotheists, who believed in the one true God, felt they were called upon and empowered by God, instructed by God, to take thousands of innocent lives because the people they believed, who they killed, held the wrong belief about God. The one true God we read about in the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran. This kind of violence in the name of the one true God is not only found in Islam, although we find many examples of it in recent times. There are Jewish zealots, thankfully a very small number, but the man who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel, felt he was called upon by the God of Israel to punish Rabin, and felt that he was doing justice, not carrying out a murder. We have examples in the Christian community, a man who put the crosshairs of a sniper rifle on a doctor who performed abortions. And his defense when he was brought up on charges of murder was justifiable homicide. Justified by whom? By God. This idea, too, goes to the heart of monotheism. God himself is quoted as saying in the Bible, is his very first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And so the idea developed in monotheism that there is one God, one truth, one right way. And the natural and logical extension of that idea is that if you dare to hold a different idea, worship a different God, worship the one true God in the wrong way, that you are committing not just an error, but a sin, not just a sin, but a crime, and a crime punishable by death. There's a moment in the Torah, it's part of the Exodus story. It's one of the great shattering contrasts in the Bible. At one moment, Moses is called to Sinai. He's in the presence of God. God bestows upon humankind all of these great compassionate laws that I've referred to at the outset. And while he's getting the Ten Commandments and all those other commandments, as you know so well, down on the desert floor, the Israelites are doing what? What are they doing? They're breaking the very first commandment. They've already made a golden calf and they're worshiping it. And God vows to commit the first Holocaust. This is quite an amazing moment. The God of Israel says that it is his will to destroy Israel, man, woman, and child, and to start over again with a new chosen people, and they will be the offspring of Moses. Moses at that moment does something that is very important for people to bear in mind. He argues with God. He scolds God. He gives God a little sermon. And says it would be wrong to do this, and in fact manages to change God's mind. In the very next moment, however, Moses is shown to do something which I would argue has changed the history of the world in ways that are just too horrible to contemplate. Moses, we're told, goes down from the mountain. He enters the camp of the Israelites. He calls around him the young men of the tribe of Levi, his tribe. And the Bible tells us he orders every man to strap sword to thigh and to go from gate to gate in the camp and slay neighbor, friend, kin. These are the worshipers of the golden calf. 3,000 die. Not at the will of God. It's not one of those moments in the Bible where God causes the earth to open and swallow the sinners, which is a supernatural moment, and it's God's responsibility. This is a human being like ourselves. The Bible makes a very strong point that Moses is just a man, just a human. But he feels authorized and empowered and even obliged to commit murder in the name of God. And those men in the cockpits of those planes on 9/11 felt they were doing what Moses did. The man who assassinated Rabin felt he was doing what Moses did. That's a dangerous, dangerous precedent. Now, I want to compare that with what were the core values of the world, the civilization, against which Judaism and early Christianity set itself, the world of paganism. Now, I want to be very careful to define my terms. Paganism is a very loosely used term. It's a pejorative term in the world in which we live, the tradition in which we live. It's used to identify anybody who doesn't believe in that one true God. I'm talking about a very specific time and place in the history of paganism. I'm talking about the world in which the Bible was first written, the world in which Judaism emerged and Christianity. It's the Greco-Roman world, the world of classical paganism, and very specifically, the world of the Roman Empire at the height of its powers. At that moment, I want to remind you, paganism was not something dark, primitive, superstitious, or barbaric. It was the high civilization of the known world. And it remains a model of elevated cultural achievement. To this day, when we speak of classical architecture, classical literature, classical philosophy, we're talking about pagan literature, pagan art, pagan philosophy. And it had its own morality, it had its own ethics, it had its own sense of justice, and it was hardly the kind of barbaric practice that we read about in the Bible itself. Now, the Romans in particular and the pagan world in general was not a kind and gentle place. These were not warm and fuzzy people. The Romans were great conquerors. They went all over the world conquering other people and adding countries to their empire. I don't want to make it seem like they were great humanitarians. And they were pretty brutal about the people they conquered. But there is one point that I want to make. It's a very important point. And that is that the classical pagans, contrary to what is suggested in the Bible, did not practice religious persecution. They were, in fact, entirely open-minded and highly curious about other people's religions. And the Roman legions that marched all over the world conquering countries never tried to punish people for their religious beliefs. In fact, the Romans were so fascinated by the religions that they found in the places they conquered, including the Jewish homeland of Judea, that they borrowed these ideas, assimilated these ideas, and brought these ideas into their own religious practices. The world of classical paganism was a free market in religion. It was a bazaar of religion in which you could pick and choose any god or goddess, any combination of gods or goddesses, or for that matter, none at all. We have an example I write about in my book of a Roman emperor whose personal chapel included all the figures you might expect to find in a pagan's sanctuary, the gods of Greece and Rome, but also Isis from Egypt and Mithra from Persia, and even Abraham and Jesus, who he had heard about and felt were worthy of honor and reverence as well. Now, against that open-mindedness and that willingness to accept and respect religious practices of other people was set this fierce idea of monotheism, that there's only one God, one right way. And those two worldviews, those two core values, cannot comfortably coexist. This is why Christianity, in the early Roman early history of the Christian Church, set itself against the Roman Empire and the Roman religious practices, and called upon itself the suspicion that they were not very loyal citizens of Rome. This is the origin of the so-called persecution of Christians by Rome. It was not a religious persecution. It was a political persecution, because these Christians, out of faith, out of a very, very fierce faith, refused to do those simple gestures of civic virtue that the Romans called upon all citizens to do. It consisted of really no more than taking a pinch of incense and casting it on a little flame in a brazier before an image of the emperor, who was understood to symbolize the welfare of the Roman state. It was a little bit like what we ourselves have done and what we ask our children to do in school. You put your hand over your heart and say the Pledge of Allegiance, and you recite words that include "under God." We don't think of this, at least most of us don't think of it, as a great religious gesture. We think of it as a kind of a minor, modest gesture of civic virtue, and that's what the Romans asked the Christians to do. Interestingly enough, they didn't ask the Jews to do it, and they showed great deference to the religious sensibility of the Jews at most times and places. There was a law in effect during the Roman occupation of Judea that prevented Roman legions from marching around the streets of Jerusalem with their regimental insignia showing, because those insignia were often images of animals, especially the golden eagle that was a symbol of Rome. And out of deference to the sensibilities of their Jewish subjects, they would cover those up with a sack so as not to give offense. They respected Judaism in a way that they did not respect Christianity, because Judaism was considered to be a very ancient religion, a religion based on texts, for which they had great respect. Christianity, of course, at a very fateful moment, insisted that it was not Judaism. It started out within Judaism, but quickly separated from Judaism. And by cutting itself off from this Jewish tradition, they were denied this special dispensation. This led to the confrontation between people who, frankly, were true believers. They were zealots. And they sought out opportunities to defy these, what was expected of them by Roman authority. The historical record contains the proceedings of a trial of one so-called Christian martyr who had charged into a pagan temple and torn down the idol, the statue that he saw there, just as he felt he was commanded to do. "You shall tear down their altars and smash their idols." He'd read that in his Bible. And, of course, he thrust himself into the light of authority. He was dragged to trial. And the magistrate said, "Oh, unhappy man, are there not enough cliffs and high places that you have to force me to take your life?" This was the Roman attitude towards Christian true belief. We can see this contrast in a very instructive passage in the New Testament, where Paul, the first Jew for Jesus, describes his missionary travels around the ancient world, and he goes to Athens. What is Athens? It's the seat of classical paganism. It's the seat of Greco-Roman culture, of Greek culture. And he sees there, as we read in the New Testament, an inscription on an altar, "To the unknown God." And Paul says that he suddenly realizes that these benighted, ignorant pagans in Athens were unwittingly, ignorantly worshiping the one true God. They simply were too stupid to know his name. And so he sermonizes to these pagans, I see that you are worshiping the right God, and I'm here to tell you his name. Now, it's an interesting moment because it corresponds to something that we know about the religious practices of the pagan world from archaeology. Archaeologists have recovered numerous altars that are inscribed in almost the same way that Paul describes, but not quite, and the difference is instructive. Paul thinks the inscription says, "To the unknown God." What archaeology has recovered are altars that are inscribed to the unknown gods. Now, this is an important difference because it was part of the theology of paganism to be equal opportunity worshipers. They had a healthy agnosticism. They were not sure, in the way that Jews and Christians were sure, who the right God was, or the right God at the right moment for the right thing. They had specialist gods. So if you wanted healing from illness, you might pray to one God. If you were going on a trip, you might pray to a different God. If you're if you were pregnant and you wanted a healthy childbirth, you'd pray to a different God. And so they prayed to a lot of gods. It was what one of the sources that I quote in my book calls spiritual over insurance. And so a prayer or a sacrifice offered at the altar to the unknown gods was like a prayer or a sacrifice addressed to whom it may concern. And this, I would suggest to you, is a praiseworthy gesture. There's a pagan orator who boasts about it. While other nations and kingdoms honor only their respective gods, the Romans respect the gods of all the others. They search out everywhere these foreign gods and adopt them for their own. Nay, they have even erected altars to the unknown gods. Now, my book focuses on precisely that moment, one of the great what-ifs of history, when a militant Christianity sets itself against the world of classical paganism, a world of religious toleration, a world of religious diversity, and tries to turn the hearts and minds of the population of the Roman Empire to one God, away from many gods to one God. And we know a great deal about how this happened, where and when and why it happened, and to whom it happened. These are events, unlike much of what happens in the Bible, that takes place in the full light of history. And we have records of the human beings, men and women like ourselves, who participated in these events. And the crucial moment took place during the 4th century, when famously a pagan emperor named Constantine comes to the throne as the absolute ruler of Rome. He has placed his bet on the eve of a particular battle that turns out to be a crucial battle. He invokes the protection of that new God he had heard about, the Christian God. And faithfully, you might say accidentally, he won that battle. And so he felt the Christian God must be a pretty good God as far as he is concerned. And so he decriminalizes the practice of Christianity, which, as I've explained to you, was considered to be politically suspect. And he raises Christianity to a status of equality with all the other religions of the Roman Empire. This is a point that's often overlooked in church history. The first decree of Constantine on coming to the throne is not to make Christianity the state religion of Rome and to exclude all other religious practices. All he did was to say Christians may have the same freedom that everyone else has and can compete in that marketplace of religions that was ancient Rome. But they didn't have access for the first time in their history to power through the agency of Constantine. And at that moment, we see exactly how fierce and punishing these ideas can be. History records 10 classical persecutions of the Christians by pagan Rome. That's pious church history. We don't know a lot about how many people were actually persecuted or how much of this persecution they called upon themselves. What we do know is that during the first 2 years that Christianity enjoyed imperial favor in Rome under Constantine, when Christians were given access to the courts, to the police, to the public torturer, the public executioner, they turned upon those people whose religious beliefs and practices they most fiercely disapproved of, and they turned all these instruments of state power up against their enemies. Who were their enemies? Not the Jews, not the pagans, it was their fellow Christians. And more Christians died in the first 2 years of Christian access to state power than during all the 10 persecutions of Christianity by Rome. This was that fierce, punishing, bloodthirsty attitude that we first read about with Moses, and we see again in the early history of the Christian church. They're going after those people who choose the wrong belief. The word heresy, by the way, it's a Greek word. It was unknown to the Greeks and Romans. It's simply a concept they did not understand for reasons I hope I've made clear to you now. The idea that there was a false religious belief or a religious belief that should be punished was simply incomprehensible to them. What does the word heresy mean in the Greek language? Does anyone know? Choose. It means choice. Heresy means choice. The freedom to choose in the eyes of the true believer is the crime itself. Because if you have the freedom to choose, there is a danger you will choose wrongly. And so against those Christians who have chosen wrongly in the eyes of the Orthodox Church, punishment was meted out. By the way, one of my sources, I hope you will find this amusing, I did. One of my sources in my book was a very pious church history called Great Heresies of the Christian Church. And it starts with the very early catalog of heresies and schisms, or a great many of them, the most hated of which was the Arian heresy, which was a belief system within Christianity about the nature of Jesus, whether he was like God or not like God. It's a very complicated question. But the author of this book writes with complete seriousness that the last surviving expression of the Arian heresy, which began in the 3rd century, is the Unitarian Church. So you might congratulate yourselves on preserving this fine tradition. I'll take two more minutes to sum up, and then I'd be happy to take some questions. My book focuses on a moment of confrontation that takes place after the death of Constantine and at the moment that his nephew Julian comes to the throne. Julian is a very remarkable and underappreciated figure. He is raised as a Christian through a series of circumstances that we might call completely accidental. He comes to the throne and immediately reveals to everyone that he is not actually a Christian. He repudiates his Christian upbringing. He declares himself to be a pagan, and a pagan in the old and fine sense of being a person dedicated to religious liberty. He says, we're going back to the old way of things where people can pick and choose. He even makes a gesture to the Jewish people by deciding that they can rebuild the temple that one of the previous Roman emperors had destroyed, thus fundamentally changing the way Jews practice their religion. Julian said, you can have your temple back and I'll build it for you. And in fact, he begins to build the third temple. How Judaism might have changed if we'd gone back to slaughtering sheep and goats at a temple in Jerusalem is something to ponder as well. This is a great experiment in religious liberty. It was a effort by a visionary and revolutionary and highly charismatic man to give the world in the 4th century what it took 1,500 years to achieve, and that is freedom of religion. What I suggest is the pagan value that we all embrace is the idea that we respect the right of every human being to pick and choose his or her faith, to pick or choose no faith at all. This is the idea of classical paganism. This is the idea that Julian tried to reintroduce. He reigned for only 18 months. He died at the age of 30. He died, by the way, where American soldiers are dying at this very moment, a battle fought just outside the site of modern Baghdad. And his successor was another Christian emperor. Within 50 years, all religions but Christianity had been criminalized, and the history that unfolded thereafter was the history of Inquisition and Crusade and countless martyrdoms and much bloodshed and violence. So the great what-if that I ask in my book, and I'll leave with you this morning, is what if we had achieved this sublime goal of freedom of religion, freedom to choose, 1,500 years ago instead of more recently. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you.
Thank you. We're going to have a brief panel. I've got a question or two. Rabbi may have a question or two, and then we'll open it up to the larger group. Two things strike me. One, I'm going to be seemingly guileless in this one, and that is to ask, what is polytheism and what is monotheism? When you spoke, it seems to me, in reading your wonderful book, and it is very interesting, and there are, believe it or not, laughs. I may tell you about that or not. And it's wonderful scholarship. But when you describe, just a few moments ago, the over-insurance, it seems to me that you could be describing modern Catholicism and the repurposing of the gods into saints and into intermediaries, where you pray to a saint for intervention, where the big feminist controversy in Roman Catholicism right now is Mary a co-redemptrix? When I look at the issues that seem to be latent in every seemingly monotheistic system, I see the prophet Manny. I love it that there's a prophet Manny. He'll explain that to you. And I see a Zoroastrian kind of dualism of good and evil. And so tell me how the pagans, in a sense, given the date of Christmas, given Ophagia, the communion, the eating of the god, which was a Greek practice, haven't the pagans won?
Well, there's much to ponder in a very erudite question. First, let me say, polytheism simply means many godism, and monotheism means one godism. And the idea of polytheism was that there is more than one god, not just one god, but many gods. But I make the argument that classical paganism really takes an important step beyond that. It's not just that they affirm with zealous true belief that there are many gods. They have a healthy skepticism about whether there are exactly how many gods there are and which ones they are. There was even a tendency towards what I call in my book pagan monotheism, because Constantine himself had the idea of, well, maybe all these many gods are simply reflections of one God, one all-powerful God. The phenomenon that you have talked about is very, very important to understand, and it plays an important part in my narrative. The early Christian church understood that it had to put over this idea, of this radical new idea of one Godism, to a population that loved polytheism. It loved all the rituals and all the imagery and all the holidays and festival days and ritual sites and pilgrimage sites that were associated with these many beautiful gods and goddesses. And so at first, the true believers in Christianity shunned them entirely. There's a sermon that I reproduce in my book by a man named Martin of Braga, who says, well, all those Greek gods that you love so much, Athena and Jupiter and Apollo, they're really just minions of the devil. It's just the devil masquerading in these pleasant disguises. And you can't, Paul says, you can't drink from the cup of the Lord and the cup of the devils. You must shun them. But the practical-minded church leaders of a later century said, let's simply repurpose paganism to Christianity. And so, for example, the iconography of Isis, a pagan goddess of the Egyptian pantheon, hugely popular in the ancient world. She was like a superstar. You have to imagine what Marilyn Monroe is in our popular culture to understand what Isis was. They simply borrowed all of the iconography of Isis and transferred it to the Virgin Mary. Rather than telling all of the peasantry, you may not go to the pagan shrines that you are accustomed to going to pray, they simply said, well, that shrine which used to be dedicated to a pagan god is now the site of a church dedicated to a martyr. The martyrs became saints. The saints became a whole system of what cultural anthropologists would call demigods. Now, Catholics don't want to call them that, but that's certainly true. And then you make the most impressive and I think funny point is that the church at an early date said, even though the gospel paints the picture of the birth of Jesus as taking place in the spring, we're going to celebrate it on December 25th, which was a feast day in the pagan calendar, and the masses were accustomed to celebrating, so we'll give them something to celebrate that's sanctified, and that's how Christmas came to be December 25th. It was an accommodation.
One more before the rabbi, and that is, well, I shouldn't tell you this, so don't listen too carefully. Last night I drank scotch and water, and I got drunk. The night before I drank gin and water, and I got roaring drunk. The night before that it was bourbon and water, and I'm going to give up water. I just gave a talk before services on Freud, and one of the things that I noticed is that Freud did not suffer heterodoxy, that when he came out with his ideas, anyone that disagreed was shown the door and was condemned, anathema, and apostate. Karl Marx and the Marxists who followed him, again in a non-theological system, seems to have done the same thing, with great slaughters being done when you defied the orthodox interpretation of Marx or Mao or Stalin. And so my question is it the water of monotheism, or is the common factor here human beings and our inability to tolerate difference?
Well, let me say this. I want to concede, I'm usually asked whenever I talk about this subject, what about the polytheists of India? They're polytheists, but they're not so tolerant. They have their own religious passions and their own assassinations and war. The human genius for finding reasons to hate each other is measureless. So I concede that point. But I do say, to use your analogy, that monotheism is the water that feeds a certain, or it nurtures a certain kind of extremist behavior and intolerant behavior. And it can be translated from vocabulary to vocabulary while always remaining the same. I think Freud is an excellent example. Freud was an autocrat. There are writers who have said that his designation of Jung as his successor was like, compared to God the Father and God the Son, that it was a passing of this divine authority. I quote in my book a German historian named Hermann Doris, who makes the point that the idea of paganism was an idea of power sharing. Just as there were many gods in the heavens sharing power, there were many sources of power on earth and in Rome. This was concrete. There was the Roman Senate, which was a form of proto-democracy, and there were multiple office holders in the office of emperor. At the time Constantine was fighting his famous battle, there were, by law, four emperors. And they consciously said, each of us is under the protection of one of the many gods of the pantheon, and we'll share power down here just as the gods share power in heaven. Why did Constantine choose Christianity? Well, one argument is he didn't want to be one of four emperors. He wanted to be the one and only emperor. And the wars that he was fighting were wars to make himself the sole and absolute emperor of Rome. And it was very convenient for him to have as his champion God and to have the political support of a church that shared his preference for autocracy. And he said, one God in heaven, one emperor on earth. The quote that I'm going to close with is, his slogan, it was actually something that he used to chant, was one God, one Logos, which is part of the Trinity, one God, one Logos, one emperor. And Hermann Doris says, the perversions implicit in this formulation became manifest in the words of Louis XIV. His slogan was, one king, one law, one faith. and in the vastly more sinister slogan of the Nazis, one people, one nation, one Führer. So this dangerous idea, which appeals to something dark in human nature, starts in monotheism and can be transmitted into many different forms.
If I may be so bold to answer your question, the what if question that you posed, at least from a Jewish perspective, the answer would have to be there would have been a hell of a lot fewer Jews killed over the centuries.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And certainly, and Christians too. And,
yeah, but at least from a Jewish point of view, that would have been the what if. I would only like to say in response, if that's the right word, my reaction, so to speak, would be, at least from what I know of Judaism and Jewish history, is that I think there is a major difference between Judaism and Christianity and Islam, at least the development historically, and that would be that the Jews, at least in the last 2,000 years, never had didn't until 1948, did not have a nation state. So the Jewish people were basically, in terms of history, we were not the ones to actually affect history or to create or to make history or to impose our will on other people. Much of Jewish history is simply a reaction to what was happening to us, whether it was in the Christian era or in the Muslim era. And of course, we know there were lots of good times too. There was the Golden Age of Spain, and there were a variety of other times that Judaism and Jews actually thrived. Personally, I tend to look at humanity as continuing to evolve and to develop and hopefully at least to evolve and develop in a positive and more open way. I don't know if there's any way to guarantee that had Constantine picked polytheism that there would have been any less slaughters over the centuries. I mean, I don't know if that's any way you can absolutely guarantee that. But I would like just for you to respond to this, because you were asking the question at the end, and that is, why did it take the 1,500 years until we actually got the acceptance? And I would just say that I think that it wasn't until you had the separation of state and church here in America that then allowed for the absolute acceptance of others. Of course, we could argue whether or not we actually have that even today. But certainly the fact that we have separation of church and state as a core ideal of American life and a core ideal of American society certainly has allowed, I can't speak of other religions and faiths and cultures, but certainly has allowed the Jewish people to thrive in this land unlike any other in any time in our history.
Thank you. Yes. It's a very astute question and a very astute observation. One of the arguments I make in my book is that monotheism, when it is a matter of free choice, has been, or at least in its early stages, a failure. When people were free to pick and choose, they chose not to be monotheists, and the best evidence of that is the Torah. The Torah is the story of how the Israelites were offered this wonderful gift by God and repudiated it. And it goes down through the entire Hebrew Bible, the stiff-necked, heretical Israelites, who the prophets rail against, for failing to live up to their part of the bargain with God. At what point in history was monotheism successful? It was most successful at those points in history where the government made you be a monotheist. The first example I use goes all the way back to the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who's the first recorded monotheist in history. He was an absolute monarch. He said there's only going to be one religion, only one shrine will be open, all the rest will be closed, and that's the way it's going to be. And as soon as Akhenaten was dead, his religious innovation was repudiated and forgotten and literally chiseled out of the inscriptions. and the Egyptians went back to the ways they preferred. The same is true of Jewish history. The Bible preserves a very intriguing and important record of a king named Josiah. Josiah, according to modern Bible scholarship, was the king, the biblical king, who made Judaism what it is today. That before Josiah and after Josiah, kings and commoners alike in the Jewish world were polytheists or syncretists. They engaged in multiple forms of religious practice. Only when you had a strong king who was a committed monotheist was there a moment in history where it was pure. And then the next example is Constantine. What I think what you put your finger on, it's a very important idea, is religion and state were wed in the pagan world. I made this point that you were a test of political loyalty was that you're supposed to put a pinch of incense on the fire and pray for the welfare of the emperor, because the welfare of the emperor was the welfare of the empire. But when the religion that's wedded to the state is polytheistic, it's saying you could be any religion you want as long as you make a gesture towards the state. When the state says, no, it's not going to be any religion, it's going to be the one approved religion, and all other religions will be punished, then you come to the horrible situation that we find in Western history, and believe me, we find it in Iran today. That's a theocracy.
We have time for about four questions. Only the Unitarians put their hands up? Dennis.
Perhaps this is a misunderstanding on my part. There are several members here today, or several people here today who might help me out. The first verse of the Bible is, in the beginning, God created, etc. That word God, is in Hebrew, my understanding is that Elohim. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds like a plural word to me. Please explain.
Well, look, I make the argument in my book, and in other books I've written, that the first expressions of Judaism were not monotheistic. And that's one important clue. Elohim literally is a Hebrew word that literally means gods. It's a plural word. And the plural pronoun is used in the Bible, we. There is an argument that has been made that it is not until you get to the era of the classical prophets, especially Jeremiah, that you get pure, unadulterated monotheism in Jewish tradition. We have archaeological inscriptions that go back very far in history where Israelites were saying, may you be blessed by Yahweh and his Asherah, meaning his goddess, wife, who in the Bible is condemned as a terrible abomination. That's a very sound argument, that the earliest understanding of Judaism was that there were many gods. It's just that the God of Israel was the one that the Israelites should pray to, and everybody else could pray to their own God.
And now, with a responsible opposing point of view,
only half opposing. First of all, it's important to know the Hebrew. Breshit bara Elohim. There's no question that the word Elohim has a plural form. But if the structure of the Hebrew sentence, the noun is not what's important. The verb is the centerpiece of the Hebrew verse or Hebrew sentence. And therefore, you have to look at the verb, not the noun. And if you look at the verb, which is Breshit bara, it's in the masculine singular.
Here, Hang on, everybody. This is why the Jews have survived as long as they.
There is ending of the writing of books.
I just want to make this one point, if I may. There is another way to understand this grammatical point, which the rabbi is entirely correct about, and that is that the text as we have it was regularized. It was edited, you might say. It was censored. So that this root word that became attached to the noun for God, Elohim, which was a plural word, was understood by the ancient rabbis to be unsettling and provocative. Why is it a plural word? What are we going to do about that? We are monotheists. And so the custodians of the biblical text might, at a very early stage, very well have regularized the grammar to make it function as a singular which is how we use it. We don't think of, we don't say gods in translation, we say God. But it's, the argument remains that there's an intriguing clue here beneath the grammar as to why the word took plural form.
There's a very interesting kind of etymological issue. There is a singular form of Elohim, which sounds like it's Hawaiian, Aloha, and it is the root of Allah, the God, the God. When you ask a group, do Christians and Jews worship the same God, you sometimes get the answer yes. You sometimes get the answer no, and the real answer is depends on whether we mean the etymology or the theology. You have the Jewish God, the singular form of Elohim and Allah, clearly etymologically related. But you have Jupiter and Zeus and Deus Zeus Petar, who becomes Jupiter, who becomes Deus Petar, is clearly related out of a pagan tradition. So that when you look at the semantics, and no one here is anti-Semitic, you're going to see that the relationships of these theologies come out of some vastly different traditions. And the questions that we're always looking at, are we looking at the stories, the philosophies, the words, or the theologies? Jim.
Probably the thing that has marked the last 1700 years most significantly is science. Science has learned to control nature for the betterment of mankind. I suspect that science was made possible by a monotheistic point of view, that there's one truth that's true today and true tomorrow, so you can study it and model it and learn to control it. If we didn't adopt this monotheistic attitude, we may have been at the same level as the Romans were.
Let me respond.
Let me finish the question. So, could it be that we have to accept monotheism in the same spirit as a polytheism? That it has value, and we have to find some balance between these two points of view. But the monotheism is a very important part of our civilization we can't let go of.
Well, let me just make this one, because it's a very important point to me, personally. There's a wonderful series, it's now mostly forgotten, called The Ascent of Man. It was featured Jacob Bronowski. It was a history of science, really, essentially. His episode, this was a series of documentaries, short documentaries, the episode that he created about the Holocaust. He wanted to confront the experience of the Holocaust, from which he was a refugee and a survivor. He took the face of a Polish scientist of his acquaintance, and he showed us what it looked like with a photograph, what it looked like with an X-ray, what it looked like with ultraviolet light, what it looked like with all different forms of measurement and perception. And he says, that's the heart of science. That it is not one truth. And he said the reason that Nazism took the monstrous proportions that it did and the monstrous acts that it did was that it refused to accept that reality could be perceived in many, many different ways. Science has ascended to the uncertainty principle, the wave-particle duality. There isn't a one true God of science. And we were betrayed by that idea. The monotheistic idea, the Newtonian idea, turned out to be the wrong idea. And it was only because science had a healthy agnosticism, an open-mindedness, that it ascended to the plane that it now occupies. So I would argue, rather than following the monotheistic model, it followed the polytheistic model.
We're gonna-